In his new book, Saving Our Cities, William Goldsmith shows how cities can be places of opportunity rather than places with problems. With strongly revived cities and suburbs working as places that serve all their residents, metropolitan areas will thrive, thus making the national economy more productive, the environment better protected, the citizenry better educated, and the society more reflective, sensitive, and humane. Goldsmith argues that America has been in the habit of abusing its cities and their poorest suburbs, which are always the first to be blamed for society's ills and the last to be helped. He writes about all of this in his new book, Saving Our Cities, A Progressive Plan to Transform Urban America. Bill Goldsmith is Professor Emeritus of City and Regional Planning at Cornell University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Bill, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure entirely.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this plan and devising it and putting it together?
Well, I've been a scholar studying cities and city planning for, about half a century. And I suddenly came on the realization, it had been brewing in me for a long time, actually, since my youth in San Francisco, where I grew up in what's called the Central City now, that cities and the city planners that I was training at Cornell in graduate school had lots and lots of good ideas of things to do for cities, but they couldn't get them done because the cities were getting beaten up from the outside. So I have a super quick metaphor for that. Tom Johnson, who was mayor of Cleveland, 1901 to 1909, said, it is noble. It's a good thing to pull floating bodies out of the river so they don't drown. But it would be so much more useful to stop others upstream from throwing them in the first place. So I began to think, who's beating up our cities and why? And that's what I wrote this book about.
When you look at this idea of saving our cities, what are we saving them from? Give us an idea of the problems and what ultimately we are trying to accomplish.
Well, ultimately what we're trying to do is get people good places to live, good food to eat, good schools to go to, safe neighborhoods, things like that. I find four things beating up on the cities. One, the federal Congress cuts budgets through austerity, the 99.1% stuff. Second, better off suburbs strangle cities so that their schools are not adequate. Third, a relatively small set of giant corporations, which manage to feed us very well, also feed us way too much with way too much salt, sugar, and fat. And if you live in a big city neighborhood, you end up spending a lot of your time at fast food restaurants, and you can't get access to fresh fruits and vegetables and grains because there aren't grocery stores nearby. And fourth, there's a narrow set of politics, ideology, and financial interests that push the drug war on poor city neighborhoods of color. And those four things together are really making things tough on cities. That's what's tossing cities into the rapids. And I think cities realize it. They elect Democrats as mayors, and they haven't yet come together to fight this out. I think this election we just had may be a chance for them to do that.
We'll talk a little bit about that and what the future holds in just a moment. When it comes to the cities themselves, is it one size fits all, or does it really depend on the size and the leadership of the individual city?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure I really know the answer, but I'll venture a try. I guess I do. My answer is any city over a couple hundred thousand or any metropolis over, say, a quarter million suffers from these problems. And I think it's pretty uniform. It's pretty much everywhere. It's in medium-sized cities. It's not in small cities necessarily, but it's in medium-sized cities and large cities and giant cities. I think these pressures from the outside, the budget cutting, the federal budget cutting, is just uniform. And I actually, in the book, use examples from giant cities like New York and Detroit and small cities like Woonsocket, 40,000 people in Rhode Island, filled with former French Canadians. In these cases, their budgets have been slashed from the outside. They've been pressured to undertake austerity measures, and they suffer. Big city schools, now there the school cities have to be bigger, but they don't have to be more than, say, 100,000 or so, certainly 150,000, cities like Syracuse, Rochester, Albany, Buffalo. I live in upstate New York, so I'm very familiar with these cities. Their school districts are simply not providing adequate education to the kids who live in them. The drug war, yeah, it's more in big cities, but it's also in little cities all over the place. The food insufficiency, yeah, once again, I think it's everywhere. Well, the school food programs have the same problems in schools all across the country. Yeah, so I guess I do have an answer to the question, which is it's not simply a matter of city size. It's just about all central cities are getting beaten up.
When we talk about getting beaten up, was there ever a golden age? Was there a point where our cities had the best of us?
Maybe not golden, but certainly sunnier than today.
Right.
Oh, yeah. There was a period following the Second World War that ran up until at least the late 1960s, more likely 1975, even 1980, which is, of course, marked by the election of Ronald Reagan, where city budgets increased. People with a high school education or less could get a well-paying factory job. They were unionized. Their incomes went up. This was true for white Americans and for African Americans. It was also true for immigrants of all sorts. So, yeah, it was an up escalator for a very long time. Increasing numbers of people managed to buy houses. Disproportionately white, that's for sure. They moved to the suburbs. There it's almost exclusively white until the last 15 or 20 years. Things got better. Yeah. Schools got better. Transfer programs from the federal government got better. Health programs got better. Yep, I would say it goes till about 1980, and then for 40 years, we've had really, really steep, 1975, 1980, really steep downturns. Withdrawal of federal funds from cities, prosecution of the drug war, which gets announced by Richard Nixon as a new drug war. We hadn't had one in quite a while. These things really harm cities drastically.
You certainly talk about poverty and poverty being a problem in the cities, but you also focus more on economic equality than you do on poverty. Talk a little bit about those issues and how ultimately we can address economic inequality.
Well, I think there are two ways we have to address economic inequality. First, we do have to kickstart the economy, so there are lots of jobs, and those jobs should be near the bottom. I think the Obama administration made a terrible mistake in saving the banks but not saving the people who had mortgages. I think we need to direct policies in almost in both directions at the same time. At the same time, you said and you're right that I focused on inequality rather than just poverty. It's not the single cause, but the inequality, the explosion of very high incomes at the very top, I think is closely related to the problems that cities have. You know, in 1941, the famous Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said this. He said, we may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we cannot have both. Well, I think we're coming to that realization. You know, we now all use the language of Occupy Wall Street. We all know what somebody means when they say the 1%. Yeah, it may not be 1%, it may be 3% or 5%, but we know what they mean by 1%, and we know what they mean by 99%. And austerity, you know, austerity is something the federal government does to the states do to the cities, and the cities do to poor neighborhoods. So I think this kind of inequality, this withdrawal of funding, doesn't only cause poverty, but it also causes lack of services, decayed areas, inadequate housing, things of that sort that are very, very serious. And the inequality drives it. It drives it. I think this is one of the explanations for the election we just went through. People say, wait a minute, it's not fair. These guys at the top are making out like bandits, and we're not getting any better. I think this is a big deal.
Just on that, we seem to, what we have been told following the election, is that more of that came from the rural areas than it did from the urban areas. But you think that there's a follow-through and a through line there between the urban and the rural areas?
Yeah, they keep saying that, and I haven't done the research I need to do to really figure that out. But look, 80% of the U.S. population lives in metropolitan areas with more than 200,000 people. That only leaves 20% for the true rural areas. And not all those are thoroughly rural, but most of them are. Okay? So I know some areas inside metropolises are former rural areas, or they're even farms, and they're small towns that have been swallowed by the expansion of metropolis. But those are basically urban areas. They're not really rural areas. So there's some nonsense going on in this reporting that will get straightened out in a while. I don't think this is a rural rebellion. There just aren't that many rural people around.
William Goldsmith is the author of the book Saving Our Cities, A Progressive Plan to Transform Urban America, and he joins us on the roundtable this morning. Bill, when you look at the election and you look at some of the proposals, the very early proposals that have been thrown out as possibilities to increase jobs and to address our cities, what do you make of those? And can you Do you believe in your plan that you can work with some of what has been proposed?
Great question. I think the emphasis on infrastructure can be extremely important for cities. Let me just give one example. In a lot of old industrial cities, there are dozens or even hundreds of street bridges that either are going to have to be closed or have already been closed that need repair or replacement. That's lots of jobs, it's lots of money, and both candidates said they wanted to stress that. We'll see if they will. School buildings need to be rebuilt on the West Coast. They need to be insured against earthquake damages. Everywhere they need to be renewed in the cities. Suburbs basically have newer schools. Water systems, look at Flint. Sewerage systems. There's just tons and tons of activity to be done that has traditionally been stimulated or sponsored by federal spending. Whether the Congress will actually allocate that money or not, I don't know. On schools, I don't know whether there'll be any interest by a Trump administration in actually improving city schools. I mean, Trump himself went to a private school. I think his kids did. He's probably pro-charter. That sounds like a disaster for me. I don't think we're going to go in the right direction. Food policy, I'm not optimistic because I think there's going to be much less regulation. I think we need more. We don't want to eat dangerous foods. We don't want to eat foods that make us fat and sick and greatly expand health costs. And yet the new administration says that it's going to try to reduce regulation across the board. So I have, on the drug war, it's quite possible that the new administration will say, hey, this drug war hasn't worked. It was nonsense. We're spending too much on prisons. We're robbing cities of their economic potential by taking people away. It's quite possible that they will say, let's just do a total turnaround. Nobody will accuse them of being soft and coddling criminals, that's for sure. Maybe they'll get wise and do what the Democrats have been unable to do in all these years.
I do want to talk about, we've talked about several of these issues, and one that we haven't talked about in depth is food policy. How much influence does the food industry have over food policy?
Tremendous influence in two ways. One is they have a great deal of influence at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other agencies that regulate food. You can think of the long multi-year struggle that turned the old food pyramid into the new food plate. Here, nutritionists and scientists battled against the food industry that wants to sell more and more and more worse and worse and worse foods and addict us to them. And the nutritionists held their own, so that the new food plate is a little better than the old food pyramid. Not all the way, but that's an uphill body, a battle against lobbyists. And it's food scientists working to try to stop addicting the American population to food that isn't very good for them. The corporations hire these guys. The second thing that corporations do is they advertise. They spend a tremendous amount of money trying to talk us into buying things we shouldn't buy and more of it than we should buy. And it's just a crash course. They've been very, very good at providing food. I mean, the United States basically has plenty of food. We feed more than the American population with our food production. Whether that will always increase, whether it's going to be enough eventually, I don't know. The food scientists argue about it. But there's no doubt they've produced a lot of food. But they've also caused us to eat way too much, and we're addicted to it. Actually, quite literally addicted to these combinations of fat, salt, and sugar that they put in. And whether the reaction against that is going to stay, I don't know. There's been great organized resistance. School food programs are getting better. They introduce gardens, kids as cooks, fresh foods, farm to market, and they may be able to train kids in ways very different from the way they used to be trained. There's been a tremendous amount of public interest. The books, Fast Food Nation, came out in 2011, then The Omnivore's Dilemma, then Appetite for Profit, then Animal Vegetable Miracle, then Raj Patel's book, Stuffed and Starved, then lots and lots of Michael Moss's Sugar, Salt, and Fat. Over the last decade, there have been about 10 or 15 important books and almost as many movies saying, hey, we're going haywire in our food thing. Cities now have food councils. They actually have public officials in charge of food in the city. Now, food's a private business. You know, private farmers, private corporations provide private supermarkets with stores where we buy our food. But people are intervening. So I think there's some light at the end of the tunnel. If we have time, I'll tell you a story about Cleveland, where there was a fight and the good guys won. It might be a light for other places.
Yes. Well, let us end on a happy note and tell me about Cleveland.
All right. Well, there was a let's see if I can find this. There was a law in 2011 that the part of its Healthy Cleveland program, Cleveland banned the use of trans fats by restaurants. But the Ohio Senate reacted, and they amended the state budget so that cities would not be allowed. They prohibited municipal regulation of ingredients used by fast food restaurants. Well, this is the kind of stuff that state governments do on behalf of the American Legislative Exchange Council and others. But the lawyers for the city of Cleveland discovered that the amendment had been written by the lobbyist for the Ohio Restaurant Association, who had sent it by email to the state's Department of Agriculture. And what the email said was that this kind of local regulation, quote, is exactly what we want to preempt with the attached amendment. Well, the offending email was exactly what the food advocates needed. Cleveland foodies had their day as a state court reversed the decision and they found the preemption by the state government of the city effort to be unconstitutional. So they said, no, we'll let the city do this. We'll let the city regulate the way food is served in fast food restaurants in the city. I think there's going to be more and more of that. It's been tried in Berkeley and San Francisco and New York and Chicago. I think there's going to be lots more of local action against against bad foods.
So overall, you're pretty optimistic.
Yeah, I got to admit the election the other day is a little scary, but I think it may be telling us that we need to redouble our efforts to promote democracy in cities. And I think if we do, we'll be on the path toward better things for all of us. I think I had argued in the book, and I guess I still think we're at a turning point. Everybody knows austerity doesn't work. Everybody knows city schools don't work, and we're all embarrassed about it. We're ranked low throughout the world. Everybody knows we have way too many people who are obese and therefore sick. And everybody knows the drug war is nonsense, doesn't stop any drug use or any drug production or any drug sales at all. It just moves it around and causes mayhem in the neighborhoods where it's prosecuted. These things are in the headlines almost every day, despite the election. I think, and lots and lots of relatively progressive mayors and city councils get elected, and I think they may seize on these issues and say, hey, this system isn't working, let's do something about it. In ways that may fit to some extent with the Trump election, and in many ways, which I think don't fit.
Bill Goldsmith is the author of Saving Our Cities, a progressive plan to transform urban America. He's a professor emeritus of city and regional planning at Cornell University. A great pleasure to have you on the program, sir. Thank you very much for being with us.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Saving Our Cities, A Progressive Plan to Transform Urban America by William Goldsmith. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.